The 2017 season of Weekend of Chamber Music has as its theme the musical soul, composers as performers as composers. The artistic directors tell us it's a plunge into music's spiritual ground of being, with programs defined by expressions of soul, both sacred and secular, and by the most basic, most expressively direct actions available to musicians, making stuff up, either on the spot or over long hours with pencil, paper, and computer. Words of Caroline Stinson and Andrew Wagoner, WCM's artistic directors. Weekend of Chamber Music will mark its 24th season, July 15th through the 30th, in and around Sullivan County, New York, and extending to Honesdale in northeastern Pennsylvania. As it happens, WVIA's Peter Wynn met up with composer and violinist and artistic director Andrew Wagoner at the Cooperage in Honesdale to learn more.
Andrew, the Weekend of Chamber Music has a really unusual kind of season coming up. This thing you're calling it the musical soul, and looking over your repertoire, there are some people that I've never heard of.
Yeah, I think in one case in particular, many people in the audience will recognize the music, but will realize that they actually never knew where the music came from, because we're playing two trio sonatas by a wonderful late Baroque Italian composer named Domenico Gallo. Gallo's music, including the two sonatas that we're playing, was used by Stravinsky in his great ballet Pulcinella. And that work went on to become one of Stravinsky's greatest hits. We knew for many years that the music was based on music from the late Baroque, but the music was misattributed to Pergolesi. And so Stravinsky actually thought that he was working with music of Pergolesi. But in fact, it was this fellow, Gallo, who worked in Venice, mostly in sacred music, but also wrote quite a lot of chamber music. And the only reason that Stravinsky and others thought it was Pergolesi is that at the time, it was typical to take the music of an unknown composer and publish it under the name of someone famous, because you'd sell more copies, you'd move more units, as they say in the trade. And so Gallo was virtually forgotten until the mid-20th century, and even since then, the word has been very slow to get out. And so we're going to do the Gallo, and then we're going to do a chamber version of Pulcinella, which Stravinsky prepared, called the Suite Italienne. And the audience will hear the original, and then they'll hear Stravinsky's version. And at that point, we hope that everybody will gain a much deeper appreciation for where this music came from and who actually composed it in the first place. And then the other cool thing is to hear how Stravinsky keeps all of the details of the music in place but transforms it into a completely different piece. And so listeners who know only The Rite of Spring, for example, will, I think, be surprised and perhaps delighted to hear that in his hands, the music still sounds recognizably Baroque, but modern at the same time. It's actually a kind of alchemy that Stravinsky pulls off. And that kind of gets us into the heart of what the season is about, because the musical soul refers both to musical spirituality, but then if we dig a little deeper, it just sort of refers to the soul of music, what music is, what makes music magical, what makes it tick at the most basic level. And so when you have a composer who can take pre-existing music, keep it very much in its original form, and yet transform it totally at the same time, there's something magical in that, and something that gets really to the heart of what it is to write a piece of music. So those are the kinds of things that we were interested in exploring.
Well, I was intrigued by the fact that you have a piece of secular music, if you will, by Domenico Gallo, when he mostly wrote liturgical music. And so many of the composers on the program this summer have some kind of connection to spirituality of some sort or other. Scriabin, for example, with the Theosophy, and then, of course, Beethoven and Brahms, both of whom were quite religious in their their highly unusual way. And then, of course, your contemporary composer, Jesse Jones, who is evidently quite interested in sacred harp music. So it's a lot of connections to the world of spirituality.
Yeah, absolutely. And we wanted that to be as eclectic and as wide-ranging as possible, so that we weren't interested in doing a season of sacred music, per se, but simply a season that allowed us to really get into what it means to feel a spiritual connection with a piece of music. So the Brahms, for example, Brahms was pretty devoutly agnostic, actually. And his German Requiem, it doesn't use any of the Latin Requiem texts. It uses sacred texts, but they're all texts that have to do with mourning and with the desire for transcendence. It's a very human Requiem. And so Brahms talks occasionally. We have a quote in our program book from Brahms in which he says, "The ideas come to me straight from God." But this is not a God he thought of as an old man with a beard. He was thinking of God in much broader, less well-defined terms. He was not a church-going type. But most of us feel that his music has an intensely spiritual dimension. And one of the beauties of music, I think, is that we can all identify with that and we can conceive of it in whatever way makes sense to us. So if we're talking about a piece of spiritual quality, it could be something that to us feels quite literally as if there's a spiritual power, what we call a real presence. Or it could simply be an emotional impact that is deeply powerful. Because the experience is non-specific, it carries no literal meaning. It's purely thought and feeling and structure and this whole world of experience that feels very real to us, but we don't exactly know what it is. It's hard. It's not something that can be quantified exactly. It lives in memory. We hear the piece, and then from then on, we hear it again within ourselves, right? We take the music on. I think it's one reason people have such a personal stake in the music that they love. All those things point to an experience that goes beyond the physical, beyond the rational, into something, again, non-quantifiable. And so for many people, that equals an experience of spirit or of soul. And so the work of Brahms we're doing is this big, sprawling piano quartet, one of his first big masterpieces. There's no program attached to the piece. There's nothing in it that has a churchy quality, except perhaps for the second movement, the slow movement, which is somewhat hymn-like, but you could also easily hear it as simply a love song. But the experience of hearing the piece as a whole has this powerful spiritual dimension because it's emotionally so rich. But then at the other end of the spectrum, we have Messiaen. And there's not a single work of Messiaen that is not in some way connected to the sacred and to his mysticism. And so this work, Cloche d'angoisse et larmes d'adieu, which in French is wonderfully poetic and is almost untranslatable, bells of anguish or anxiety and tears of goodbye, tears of farewell. It's, for Messiaen, not an explicitly religious piece, except for the bell image, but it has all the qualities in his music that he identified with this very personal, very specific view of paradise and of the nature of the soul. And he spelled all that out for us. So you can actually take what Messiaen wrote about his own music and then go into this piece and sort of trace the spiritual process. And that makes him unique as a composer. Scriabin, whom you mentioned, from his own sort of spiritualist, theosophic point of view, does something similar. But he's both less specific than Messiaen and at the same time much more wacky. So those who know Scriabin know that his last big effort was to write a massive symphonic work that would initiate the apocalypse. The piece we're playing doesn't do that, so nobody need have any concerns about that. So Messiaen is a devout Catholic, but comes from a long French tradition of Catholic mysticism, was very interested in Hinduism and in Buddhism and other world religions. Scriabin is not a Christian at all, and is typical of a late 19th century interest in the occult. and in spiritualism from a very different perspective. But the musics have certain things in common. And so that's something else we are interested in. When a piece does feel like it has this sort of real presence to it, what does that mean for the listener? What's going on in the piece that makes us think that? And why do we think that? Why should certain chords have this kind of mystical, ethereal quality and others feel more earthbound? So that we can explore that through a few different examples, the Scriabine, the Messiaen, some of the music of Jesse Jones, and to some extent even the Peace of Mind that's on the program raises some of those issues.
Well, I found it interesting that you have a piece by Heinrich von Weber. And, of course, I mean, what's known about him is that he was one of the great violin virtuosos of all time, and yet the piece you chose was one that's very much tied to worship and mysticism.
Yes, that one. Well, this seemed, for me, and Nurit Pacht, who is going to perform that work, and Nurit is, well, we don't have enough time to talk about Nurit, but suffice it to say that she's our favorite violinist, and she brings to everything a kind of blazing individuality and brilliance, and at the same time virtuosity that's and intelligence, and so she's the complete package. She also happens to be an expert in the performance of Baroque and early music, and so when I said, is there a Bieber that you would like to play, she immediately knew which one she wanted to play, and so there was that connection. But then Bieber himself is most famous for these quite visionary, highly unusual, and again, highly mystical works for solo violin called the Mystery Sonatas. And so for this series, we couldn't do without that. In particular because Bieber had some influence on Bach. And we know Bach also as a composer for whom everything, in a sense, was sacred. Even the secular music, even the chamber music, music without text. If we know Bach and the way he thought and the way he composed, we can also, somewhat like Messiaen, we can trace the spirituality of his thinking through the music. And so we have two Baroque composers, both of whom are devout and highly committed to worship through music. And then we also have two German Baroque composers, one of whom influenced the other in the writing of violin music. So we go from the Annunciation Sonata of Bieber, and then on the same program, Nurit will play the Chaconne from the D minor Partita of Bach, which I think for anyone who knows the piece, we recognize it as one of the great, if not perhaps the single greatest sort of spiritual statement of I am, statement of identity and purpose in Western music. It just sort of towers over everything else. For Bach, it's on the same plane as, say, the St. Matthew Passion. But St. Matthew Passion takes 3 hours. The Chaconne takes, 12 to 15 minutes. So it's much more efficient in that sense.
You mentioned in passing your contemporary composer in residence for this summer, Jesse Jones, and I was interested in his interest in things like Sacred Harp music, and yet in the few samples that I heard of his music, I couldn't hear that. What's the story here? Are we going to hear something a little bit more in that direction this time around?
The great thing about Jesse Jones is that, like many artists whose point of view is informed by a personal mysticism, he has a kind of omnivorous musical appetite. Everything goes in, and then everything comes out as Jesse Jones. And so the influences, there's a big influence of mountain music and bluegrass and other world folk musics, but there's also the influence of his own spirituality, which is he's traveled a very sort of circuitous spiritual path himself. And along the way there, then, he's picked up an interest in microtonality, so the exploration of tuning systems that are different than the standard Western tuning, which produces a whole kind of kaleidoscopic sound that goes way beyond what we're accustomed to in traditional music. And he puts all these things together in his imagination in ways that are not always expected. So one thing that his music has in common with Sacred Harp music is that Sacred Harp music really depends on resonance, on the resonance of one voice in harmony with another. and on a particular way of pronouncing the syllables in the text that almost sounds comic or stereotyped at first, because it is so typical of an Appalachian way of pronouncing the English language. But it's not stereotype. It's that when one pronounces the syllables in that way, incredibly nasal, you know, so that Amazing Grace. You know, if I were to say that, you know, that would sound like fodder for late night comedy. But in fact, when I sing it that way, the resonance of the sound is amplified, and the human voices suddenly become their own amplifiers. And so there's something that happens with resonance that's very special in Sacred Heart music. And that's the kind of thing that he likes to work with in his music. Now, in one of the pieces we're going to play, this is more evident, the Four Bagatelles for Piano Quintet, which our group, Caroline Stinson, co-artistic director and my better half, of course, our group commissioned that work from Jesse. And it's as brilliant as his biggest, most profound pieces, and yet it's quite light on the surface. And it explores different kinds of dance music. And so it goes from things that have a kind of a boogie-woogie quality in one movement to a tango quality in the last movement. But in between, there are passages that have this kind of ecstatic, mystical quality. And so that's a piece that really runs the gamut. And yet it all sounds very consistent and cohesive. But then we'll also do a work of his for cello and piano called Neither Am I a Bloodless Angel, which is a beautiful, evocative title. And this is a piece that really has an affect that is, for lack of a better word, spiritual. From the beginning of the piece, you recognize that this piece really is a kind of vision. And I think listeners who hear both will really be amazed that one composer could have produced two pieces that are so varied. But as they get to know him better, they'll also hear the through line from one piece to another. And this is something that I really love about his music, and one of the things that first attracted me to his music.
Well, it's interesting to think about it, too, that even as far back as Bieber, people on this program were experimenting with ideas of tuning and so on. I mean, here we're going back to the 1600s, late 1600s, and you've got, you know, Scordatura in this Annunciation sonata. It's kind of intriguing how this kind of shot through the whole program.
It is, and that's an excellent point, and it's a great question, because it opens up so many doors, and we don't have time to walk through half of them. But one thing that we notice when we step back a little bit from our sort of day-to-day level of magnification, when we're looking at music, when we're looking at lots of things, there are things that we sort of take for granted, and we think of them as having been there always, right? So you work in broadcasting. Freedom of the press is one that is on everybody's minds these days, and we tend to think of that as something that has always been there. But of course it hasn't. It's actually a fairly recent development that we now want to preserve. And the same is true of tuning. Now, Bieber is an extreme example, somebody who, as you rightly point out, used alternate tunings as a way of expressing whatever specific spiritual image he wanted to convey. But one of the ways in which he was encouraged in that is that he lived in a time in which different systems of tuning were sort of cohabiting. And there was no single system that was absolutely dominant, no pun intended. It's also a time in which there were lots of different instruments abounding, many of which didn't sort of survive the natural selection of instrument development. And those instruments were tuned in ways which, from our perspective, are rather wacky. And so he lived in a time in which there were models for this kind of thing, and they were very rich and diverse. And I think it's more from our perspective now, when we think of Western tuning as it's existed for the last couple hundred years, as a kind of God-given construct, that Bieber seems particularly astonishing. Now, what's great is that the music is astonishing, but the approach is not as unprecedented as it seems to us now, but it's just as ingenious as it seems to us now.
Well, it seems to me you even have a piece of Sufi music on the program this time around. What is that about?
Well, it's about two things. One is just that I love that music. And it's music which is calibrated to produce ecstasy. And it's a tradition from within the larger Muslim tradition, which is music rich, music and dance rich, and is also highly mystical, and has also taken it on the chin from more recent forms of Islamic orthodoxy. And Sufis have had a rough time of it off and on for the last, you know, for the last millennium or so. And now, in particular, in certain parts of the world, it's difficult to be a Sufi, in particular because of the love of music and the love of ecstasy and of sort of personal revelation. In the West, we sometimes make the mistake of thinking of them as being more liberal or more unorthodox in their theology, and they would not agree with that at all. They simply see that the way they do things is actually more in line with sort of first principles than more upstart, you know, ideologies, the ones that are causing so much trouble right now. And so we thought it was important to have that part of the world represented and to have that point of view represented and to let people know that within Islamic tradition there's this ancient, long-standing tradition of expressing religious ecstasy through music and dance. That said, none of us are, we're not even novices when it comes to this music. You know, we're not even beginners, let alone experts. And so what I've done is transcribe one Sufi melody that works well on the violin, in part to put it in context with other solo violin works, including a Hebraic song, Freilach, which is a kind of a klezmer favorite, just to create a broader context and to let people hear these different aspects of religious ecstasy. And those are on the second Music Talks evening on July 27th, in which the real focus of that program is on spirituality and ecstasy, whereas the other programs are more generally this sort of variable idea of soul. You know, the Archduke Trio of Beethoven, for example, which is on the final concert, again, universally recognized as one of a handful of the great chamber music masterworks in existence. And for most people who hear it, a deeply spiritual experience. But there's nothing explicitly spiritual in the piece. It's the process of hearing the piece from start to finish that has this soul quality. But on this Music Talks, those pieces are explicitly connected with the spirit in one way or another. So after our Sufi song, we'll hear the Chaconne of Bach. We'll do some improvisation on Amazing Grace, and then we'll have the audience sing along. Yes, this year there's a sing along, but not Michael Row Your Boat Ashore or Kumbaya, but Amazing Grace, but done in the Sacred Harp style. So we'll have a quick little primer on Sacred Harp singing, and we'll throw the music up on the wall with a projector, and then we'll all sing Amazing Grace together, and that's how that evening will conclude.
Well, I love this thing here, this Murkowski from the Bag O' Tales for solo piano, yes. The John Harbison piece. Yes. That is hot stuff.
Yeah. That was almost a happy accident. John is well known to our audiences because he was resident composer 4 years ago, and we've played a couple of his pieces since. We gave the New York premiere of a recent piece of his on our spring series here at the Cooperage and also in New York. But he's also a deeply spiritual composer, an unapologetically committed composer of sacred music, and somebody who sort of squares that circle that some of us have a hard time with sometimes. Here's a brilliant, intellectual, deeply politically liberal person who is at the same time a committed Episcopalian and who writes cantatas and works for performance in the Lutheran Church alongside Bach. And his theology is his, it's personal, it's not one that I can sum up or would even attempt to, but he himself has talked about how how difficult it can be in this current environment to be a composer of sacred music. We even have a quote from him in the program where he says, the sacred composer is often asked by, you know, incredulous listeners, do you really believe this stuff? But the Bag of Tales is not a religious piece. It's a set of character pieces written for all of his favorite pianists. And the pun of the title is, of course, a bagatelle is just a short character piece. A tale, that's a direct translation of the word coda, which in musical terminology, as many people know, refers to the concluding section of a work. And so he thought of these character pieces as encores, essentially, or pieces to come at the end of a performance. And they're sort of thrown together haphazard, and so it's a bag of tales, bag of tales, bagatelles, each one dedicated to each individual pianist. We have two of the dedicatees on our series this summer, Molly Markowski and Gloria Cheng, who is widely celebrated as one of the great pianists, especially for contemporary music, on the scene today. She won a Grammy for her recording a few years ago of an early sonata of Lutosławski, written when he was quite young, never performed or recorded. It's a piece that will remind some people of the music of Szymanowski. And then on the same recording, she did a piece of Steve Stuckey and Esa-Pekka Salonen. So that's her big Grammy-winning CD. We have her playing Messiaen, Wagner, and Beethoven. And that's pretty exciting, because the chance to hear Gloria Cheng play Beethoven, that doesn't happen very often. But then we also have Molly Markowski at the start of the festival, and she is going to play the tale that's dedicated to her. And I think with John, and I don't think he would object to my saying this, even like Bach, like Bieber, like Messiaen, even the pieces of his which are not explicitly sacred have a spiritual dimension simply because that's a basic part of his musical response to life. That's part of how he hears and responds to the world. And so it's just sort of in there. Though I don't think he would call this a sacred piece by any stretch.
I also find it interesting that you have a piece on the program by Milja Watras.
Yeah. Well, this gets us to the season's subtitle, which is Composers as Performers as Composers. Because a big part of what makes music such a soul experience is in exploring it through different activities at once, and in many cases doing it in real time. And so one of the things that we do on the festival each summer is we improvise. And quite often we, as well as composers, you know, for thousands of years, have found that there's sort of a direct line from improvisation to composition and back again. And Malia is just a perfect example of how this can work. Somebody who starts life as a performer, but very early on becomes interested in composing, puts composing aside for a number of years, then in our group that we have together starts improvising, becomes deeply into improvising, such that every recital she gives now involves improvisation to some degree, and then moves back into composing to where she now self-identifies as composer-violist and not just violist who composes. And so what's beautiful about that for us is it helps to break down somewhat the artificial barriers between different musical activities, which for us feels like a spiritual enterprise, so that one can say, I'm a musician. I write music, I play music, I make music up on the spot. It's very much who I am, as well as what I do. And one thing that I like about this in particular is, to get back to your question about Bieber and tuning, this notion we have that composers compose, performers perform, improvisers improvise, is also a very recent idea, dates from the first couple of decades of the 20th century. Before that time, you know, Beethoven and Brahms both self-identified as composers, but their first celebrity came as pianists. And in the case of Beethoven in particular, he had every intention of maintaining his public profile as a pianist throughout his career. For him, the distinction between playing, improvising, and composing was really, early on in particular, almost non-existent. And the only thing that forced him from one specialization into another was deafness and the fact that he simply couldn't perform at that level anymore. And then once he enters his own interior world, in which he's largely cut off from the external physical environment, as a composer he becomes increasingly not only brilliant, but unique, and creates a world of spirit that is unlike any before or since. And, of course, most of that is genius, but a huge part of it is deafness. And had he not gone deaf, it's quite possible he would not have become nearly as great a composer, and that we would know him every bit as much, at least by word of mouth. Obviously, we wouldn't hear recordings. We would know him as a pianist. So for all the composers we admire, pretty much up through Alban Berg, we're talking about people who were known equally as players and composers. There are a few exceptions, but very few. And Berg kind of establishes a new norm for the 20th century in that he really wasn't much use on any instrument, never performed publicly, wouldn't have been caught dead doing it, but is one of the great composers of, you know, the last 100 years. But again, that's a very recent thing. So for us, Melia, to some extent, this is the model that I try, you know, as best I can to live out. Jesse Jones, also brilliant mandolinist. And the piece that he composed for the festival, we have a world premiere this time for the first time in a long time. The work that he composed for us is a mandolin quartet, and so that will feature him on the mandolin.
And heaven knows that harkens right back to the Baroque.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, and also to his own eclecticism as a composer, working in a recognizably contemporary style, but with an instrument that we associate, well, we either associate it with When the Moon Hits Your Eye Like a Big Pizza Pie, or with bluegrass music. And the work that he wrote for us brings all of that together, not so much the pizza, but the bluegrass, the mountain music, the sacred music, the sense of spirituality. And I love the title. It's called Post Hymnal for Mandolin Quartet. We haven't started rehearsing yet, so stay tuned.
Composer and violinist Andrew Wagoner, who is co-artistic director of Weekend of Chamber Music with Caroline Stinson. Andrew Wagoner spoke with WVIA's Peter Wynn at the Cooperage in Honesdale about Weekend of Chamber Music Season 2017, and we heard the theme, The Musical Soul, Composers as Performers as Composers. The festival will run July 15th through the 30th in and around Sullivan County in New York, extending to the Cooperage in Honesdale. The festival will build to this work, the Archduke Trio of Beethoven. It will get underway Saturday, July 15th at 5 in the afternoon at the Eddie Adams Barn in Jeffersonville, New York, with a barn raising, a very special program. Domenico Gallo, Stravinsky, Jesse Jones, Bach, John Harbison, John Dowland. And it is a wonderful kickoff for the entire season of Weekend of Chamber Music. And for more information, you can check their website, wcmconcerts.org, wcmconcerts.org. That's Weekend of Chamber Music, the 2017 season, and the theme, The Musical Soul, Composers as Performers as Composers. For more information on the web, wcmconcerts.org. Thanks to Andrew Wagoner, thanks to WVIA's Peter Wynn. The two met and had their conversation at the Cooperage in Honesdale, and we thank the Cooperage for hosting that interview.